has a coffee break on Tuesdays at 5:30 in the Harper Cafe, and a reading group on Saturdays at noon in Harper 145, but it's subject to change, so please check the UChicago Platypus Facebook page to confirm the room. We're ready to get started? Okay, so hi everyone. Welcome to the opening plenary of the 10th Platypus International Convention, 50 years of 1968. And so before we begin, I'll sort of introduce Platypus for those who might be unfamiliar. The Platypus Affiliated Society organizes reading groups, public fora, research and journalism focused on problems and tasks inherited from the old left of the 1920s and 30s, the new left of the 1960s and 70s, and the post-political left of the 1980s and 90s for the possibility of emancipatory politics today. And I can introduce our speakers now. On your left, we have Abdul El-Khalimat, who is a professor of African-American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and the author of numerous books, including Malcolm X for Beginners, Rethinking Afro-Cuba, and Roots and Flowers, the Life and Work of the Afro-Cuban Librarian Marta Terry Gonzalez. Then we have Joseph Estes, who is a member of the Campaign for a Socialist Party here in Chicago. Johnny Mercer, who is a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and an artist in Chicago heavily influenced by the Situationist International. And then last but not least, we have Mitchell Cohen, who was a founder of the Red Balloon Collective at SUNY Stony Brook in 1969 and is the author of a series of pamphlets collectively titled Zen Marxism, two books of poetry, and What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street, and was chair of the local station board for WBAI Pacifica Radio from 2008 to 2012, coordinator of the No Spray Coalition Against Pesticides, and an organizer with the Brooklyn Greens Green Party. And our topic for tonight is 50 years of 1968, and the description is as follows. For half a century, 1968 has represented a high watermark of social and political transformation, a year of social upheaval that spanned an entire globe. Ushered in by a new left that sought to distinguish itself from the old left that emerged in the 20s and 30s, the monumental events of 1968 set the tone from everything from protest politics to academic leftism. Today, with the U.S. entangled in a seemingly endless war in Asia, and people calling for the impeachment of an unpopular president, with activists fighting in the streets and calling for liberation along the lines of race, gender, and sexuality, the left's every attempt to discover new methods and new ideas seems to invoke a memory of the political horizons of 1968. We can perhaps more than ever feel the urgency of the question, what lessons are to be drawn from the new left as another generation undertakes a project for building a left for the 21st century? So we're going to begin with opening remarks that will be 12 minutes. Then we'll move into a section of response for the panelists, 3 or 4 minutes, and then a Q&A for the rest of our time. And I'll give you guys a knock when you have a minute left. So, Dool, would you like to begin?
Sure. Hello. It is a pleasure to have this opportunity to share my views on this important topic. As a veteran of the 1960s, my responsibility is to combine self-criticism with a challenge from those times for these times. Two critical moments for Black people's struggle set the framework for understanding the dialectics we need to learn from the time of 1968. The first was conceptually moving the freedom movement into the framework of a civil rights movement. This was a strategic rethinking of revolution into reform. But the next was moving from the civil rights movement to the Black Liberation Movement, and that was moving back from reform to revolution. What is key here is that these are not polar opposites. They are not divorced from each other. Dialectics are the key. Both are necessary, reform and revolution. The dialectics are how they are interconnected, how the tactics of reform can serve the strategic goal of revolution. And of course, the necessary way to understand a revolution is to chronicle the reforms necessary to carry out revolutionary transformation. A big event of the 1960s was the cry for black power in 1966. This emerged out of mass mobilization, the development of revolutionary cadre, the forging of motions to build vanguard organizations, and the assassination of Malcolm X in 1965, Che Guevara in 1967, and Martin Luther King in 1968. My argument is that the black struggle was an autonomous force expressing both a response to class exploitation and the particularity of racist oppression is an essential aspect of any revolutionary expression of the masses of poor and working people in the United States. There are several key examples from the 1960s. For the unemployed and inner city black youth, the Black Panther Party, 1966. For industrial workers, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, 1969. For students, the Student Organization for Black Unity, 1969. For the middle strata, the Congress of African People, 1970. The basic logic is that out of the mass mobilization of spontaneous movements, cadre emerged to form revolutionary organizations. The crisis is how the link between reform and revolution was broken, mainly by the repressive response of the state, but also by the idealist dogma that led us to believe that revolution was possible with or without the masses. This was a fundamental crisis in the revolutionary vanguard, and it is a challenge that faces us today. One of the ways this happened in the 1960s was in the context of party building. The principal aspect of the reform revolution contradiction was clearly reform in the mass movements, but for the cadre moving into revolutionary forms of organization, this was reversed, so that revolution became their principal aspect. This led to some vanguard forces moving into forms of action that de-linked from the mass struggle and was a setup for ruling class repression. Extreme examples of this are the Weathermen and the Black Liberation Army. Also, recruiting cadre from the mass battlefronts into party formations pulled many out of their mass work. Many believed that an autonomous black movement was antithetical to the class struggle, rather than seeing it for what it has always been, an expression of the class struggle arising out of the particularity of racist national oppression. Within this context, different class forces will contend for power, for leadership. This is no different than the trade union movement or any mass movement. The diverse particularities of oppression will always give rise to movements, mainly expressing the class reality of the masses of people impacted, but also being targeted by middle class forces out of their self-serving opportunism and the willingness of the ruling class to support such a form of co-optation. Fast forwarding to today, we can see a similar pattern. Today, there is a moment of mass mobilization of spontaneous movements. This has been building from the mass response to the police killing of Trayvon and so many more, from the Katrina mass mobilizations to return, to Occupy, to the Me Too women's movement, to the Fight for 15, and now the high school youth and public school teachers. This includes the Moral Monday movement coming out of North Carolina, and now the Poor People's Campaign of 40 Days of Resistance planned for this spring. But this time, the ruling class has a plan in place. The NGO foundation money is intervening with an aggressive plan for co-opting the cadre development process, using the material incentive of paid positions and a network of subsidized activities. Further, the lure of electoral politics in the form of a long march to transform the Democratic Party is set up to provide a career path for the youngsters of the March 24th leadership. What we can learn from the 1960s is the need for cadre to keep digging deep into the mass struggles of the most exploited and oppressed and anchoring cadre development there. We must base the theory we need on the summation of practice, the actual motion of historical forces. The philosophical truth is that the universal can only be found in the particular. One is an abstraction. The other is material reality. So the revolutionary road leads through each of the battlefronts, and unity can be realized when it becomes a practical necessity out of the struggle. Revolutionary cadre cannot make it happen, but they are a necessary force to facilitate when it can happen. After all, politics, whether reform or revolutionary, is the art of the possible. And if it is the art of the impossible, it's only when the impossible is possible. The 60 did not fail. That experience can show us the way forward and affirm that both reform and revolution are possible, but only when we understand their dialectical relationship. So my final advice is from a jazz vocalist named Shirley Horn. She said it this way: no complaints. This is a voice like from the 60s. And no regrets. I still believe in chasing dreams and placing bets. But I have learned that all you give is all you get. So give it all you got. Thank you. And we also have some literature here if you were interested in further.
All right, so full disclosure, I'm a member of Platypus. I first encountered the organization in 2010. I joined in 2011, and I remain an active member. But I'm not here to speak today as a Platypus member. Rather, my remarks tonight stem directly from my experiences organizing on the left over the last 4 years. First, as a witness to the Chicago Socialist Campaign, which began as an attempt by Socialist Alternative and other sectarian organizations to reproduce the Kasama Sawant phenomenon in Chicago by drafting Carlos Rosa to run for alderman as a socialist. He eventually ran as a Democrat. Then as a member of the Campaign for a Socialist Party, a small propaganda group founded in Chicago soon after Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump announced their candidacies. And recruited cohorts mainly in Chicago, New York, and California, but attracted attention in a number of localities across the states, and even in Europe recently. And finally, the inclination of my comments will also take into account my experiences over the last year and a half as a member of the Socialist Party USA, of which I am not currently a member, as well as my intermittent interactions with other leftist organizations, of which the most prominent are the Democratic Socialists of America and Chicago Against Police Brutality. The millennial radicals that emerged in the early aughts, for the most part, seemed securely tethered to the new left, to its established organizations, its practices, repeating not only its choice slogans in the streets, but even establishing the new students for a democratic society as though to tempt the fate of its most cataclysmic American episode. The left of recent memory, that of the Berniecrats and Antifa, is often labeled millennial, but I would contend that it is from the doldrums of the earlier anti-war millennial left that a separate post-Occupy left sprung fully disformed. Whereas those of us who were students in that earlier period first encountered the left on campus via anarchist hawking zines or Trotskyist pushing weeklies, or first invited to take part in the revolutionary transformation of society at a regular meeting of social democrats or a Maoist reading group. Today, many young self-identified anti-capitalists are organized, if you can call it that, in Facebook groups, subreddits, and Tumblr pages. They get their education reading eclectically from Wikipedia and leftist blogs, or from equally ecumenical vacillations via Jacobin. Their idea of activism is often confined to one-off protests and the propagation of memes or hashtags. The worst of these elements do their best to haunt the internet with various authoritarian routines like doxing or condemning leftists who don't fall in line, posturing according to the whims of momentary political hysterics. There are, of course, plenty of people who avoid this declension, young leftists with an admirable commitment to the work of actually changing people's lives. Unfortunately, most of these activists are drifting rapidly into the Democratic Party or working for large NGOs that amount to the same. a path too often characterized by such a strict hygienic avoidance of any conflict, of any contemplation of strategic or political consciousness, that they are reduced to the mechanics of tailing after chimerical movements. Both these types, the pseudo-sectarians who fantasize about street battles and FBI repressions as they descend into the echo chamber of an algorithmic social media feed, and the latter-day social democrats who, in the name of socialism, busy themselves with ill-fated campaigns that will indenture them to grunt work for so-called progressive candidates in the midterm elections, both are extremes extreme characterizations of a very real tendency. Now, I'm not some sort of neo-Luddite who's going to saddle the internet with responsibility for this abortive state of affairs, nor am I going to say that the solution lies merely in reading better books or joining older organizations. Rather, I'm asking you to entertain the notion that the left's retreat into the barbarism of the blogosphere and the actionism of the Democratic Party are symptoms and byproducts of a historical rupture in which the mistakes of a previous generation, instead of being actively rejected, have merely been forgotten. Rather than becoming more radical or beginning anew, the left has repressed its failures and must reckon with this fact if it is not to repeat them. Chris Marker's 1977 essay film, Le Fond de l'Air Rouge, or Grin Without a Cat, begins with a montage cutting documentary footage from the early 60s, of violent confrontations between protesters and police with scenes from another film, Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin, 1925. Marker's intention, as the narration hints at later in the film, was to contrast Battleship Potemkin, which was a dramatization of the failed Russian Revolution of 1905, made only after the success of 1917, with his own film. Marker's point being that unlike 1905, which Lenin referred to as a dress rehearsal for the Bolshevik Revolution, the dress rehearsal of 1968 never materialized a consequential victory. I appreciate Marker's recognition of the failure of 1966 for its of 1968 of its ethereal impetuosity, principally for its rarity. Most people talk as though it were the apotheosis of revolution, but it's a flat equation of the new left with a generation of youth whose mobilization frothed over in the late 60s remains as commonplace as it is unfortunate. The new left's origins lie with the gradual delegitimization of the post-World War II order in the 1940s and 50s, especially after Khrushchev's secret speech and the invasion of Hungary. The end of ideology, the discontent with the culture of gray flannel suits with the system, is only a surface phenomenon of a deeper depoliticization. The leaders of this first generation of the new left, especially in the United States, developed in a vacuum that the Communist Party left as it disintegrated. Whether they were social democrats, liberals, or third camp Trotskyists, the early leaders of the peace and civil rights movements, those ever capable proponents of that whole assemblage of forces that nearly provoked the crisis of the Democratic Party at its 1964 convention, were determined in their best moments to bring about a revolution as far-reaching as any that preceded it. The events of 1968 represent not a culmination of the new left's radicalization, but the full flowering of its crisis, a final expression of a decisive disillusion. The splintering of SDS often gets touted by its veterans as a tragedy of the highest order, but might be more appropriately understood as a farcical replay of Port Huron in 1962, where the sectarian reflexes of Michael Harrington and other IPSL members butt heads with the authoritarian liberalism of Tom Hayden and the SDS, severing what little hope there was for a relationship between the student movement and the new left. Nor was the Black Power turn a step in the direction of revolution. On the contrary, it is at once a tragic betrayal of the civil rights movement and a manifestation of the early new left's failure to sound the depths of the problem of Marxism and its relationship to race. The dissipating identitarian struggles of the entire period that followed 1968 are but symptoms of that original sin of identity politics, namely the reification of the consciousness of the proletariat. This backsliding of the organized working class into a mere sociological cluster to become one among many in the long ranks of gangs and rackets that was once the impetus to a search for a new revolutionary subject and a frenzied exploration of new political horizons, but today its remains are so desiccated that it inspires only a crude psychological obstinacy that masks itself as a politics of resistance, evidence that the long arm of the new left bends towards Stalinism. The post-occupied left in the end may only represent what Bayard Rustin called a cry of protest before accommodation. Its only hopes, or perhaps it's already doomed, and our only hope is a post-neoliberal left still looming out beyond the next election, is to experiment in building the left anew, and in doing so to recognize the degree to which its problems are bound up with the shuddering echoes of a deep historical wound having less to do with 1968 than with 1848. More to the point, and to plug the campaign of which I'm a part, the left needs to build a mass socialist party. Some say that the failure of SDS to do so may have been their greatest mistake, or rather, that it may have been the one thing they could have done to redeem themselves. As implausible as this may seem, the point has to be taken. The most ambitious elements of the early New Left dedicated themselves strategically to the realignment strategy. This attempt to push the Democratic Party to the left faltered in 64, it straight up detonated in 68. By 72, it was a joke. This attempt, as valiant as it may have been, is definitely not a model for what lies ahead. It was an intervention aimed at the Keynesian Ford estate. Whatever opportunity might have lied there is gone. If there were a model for building a mass socialist party in the United States, which there isn't, it would look more like the original Socialist Party of America and the Republican Party of the 19th century. These earlier phenomena also represent obstacles that need to be addressed if they're not to be repeated. The difference is that their practices are forgotten, while the New Left, though having little to do with what the left does today, is a monolith before which every aspiring radical bows.
Okay. I'm kind of here as a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And also as practicing artist, I wouldn't be making the art that I'm making if it wasn't for the Situationists. I've got a lot of sympathy for the Situationist ideas as an artist, and not so much sympathy for it as a member of the SPGP. So I'm basically going to take a slightly different format to the other speakers. I'm going to try and do this in a kind of timeline of events. I'm going to start off with the Socialist Party of Great Britain and kind of introduce you to it through its formation. And then I'm going to go into the kind of birth of the Situationist International, and then go to kind of May 68 in France. We'll see how much I get through. Just to be clear, this was a kind of last minute thing for me. I found out about this on Monday, and I've had a lot of bar shifts, which I just ran from. Sorry for being so late. I work at the Cove, and I had to kind of dash it here. I finished at 6:30. So it's all a bit all over the place. I'm slightly sleep deprived. We'll just see how it goes, okay? Hopefully it won't be too, okay, right. So, 1904, the Socialist Party of Great Britain is founded, and it's founded as a split from the Social Democratic Federation to oppose the reformism at the time, and also in part to H.M. Hindman being the kind of self-appointed leader of the party. The basic features of the Socialist Party are that we're a leaderless organization. We believe, like Marx, that the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class itself. Secondly, that socialism is a worldwide, moneyless, stateless society based on production for human need and direct access to goods and services. That the working class should use political power available to them to conquer the state and take the state power away from the bourgeoisie. In other words, although we're a leaderless organization, we're not an anarchist organization. Some people jokingly refer to us as the political wing of anarchism, which I think is fair enough. okay, so now skip forwards 50 years. 1950, Easter Mass in Notre Dame. A group calling themselves the Lectrists walk into the cathedral disguised as monks to announce Je et moi. My French is fucking awful, okay. So, Je et moi, which some of you will know, God is dead, okay.
Johnny, could you speak up a bit?
Sorry, yeah.
How about if you stand up and
project? Oh, please don't make me stand up. I'll try and project, sat down, that's right. Okay, sure, yeah. So,
Je et moi, or
Je et moi? Let's not be like that, come on, this is like.
God!
Je et moi. Put it down to what a lumpen pole I am. Je et moi, God is dead. And this sermon lasts about 5 minutes before they're almost lynched by the congregation. They save themselves by giving themselves up to the class traitors, which were the French police at the time, and save themselves a lynching. So the Letterists were the first group to understand the power of graffiti. They come up with the first slogans like "Free the passions, never work," and of course these slogans resurface in May 1968, as a lot of you will know. 1956, just very quickly, is the invasion of Hungary by the Soviet forces, and Sartre denounces this, and this is quite an important part in kind of the breakaway of the intellectuals in both Britain and France at that time from the mainstream Stalinist parties. So summer 1958, this kind of slightly weird, glossy magazine, Situationist International, appears in Paris's Latin Quarter, which declared, "A mental illness has swept the planet, banalization. Everyone is hypnotized by work and by comfort, by the garbage disposal unit, by the lift, by the bathroom, by the washing machine. This state of affairs, born of a rebellion against the harshness of nature, has far overshot its goal, the liberation of man from material cares, and become a life-destroying obsession." That's from Formula for a New City, which was published in this first Situationist International. And Guy Debord writes, "Art need no longer be an account of past sensations. It can become the direct organization of more highly evolved sensations. It is a question of producing ourselves, not the things that enslave us." So as Marxists, we might want to ask, what was the kind of class makeup of this group? And a guy called Christopher Gray, who wrote something in 1974, so not long after the 68 uprisings, described the Situationists in this way. He said, "Most were in their late 20s and were living off the usual expedients of what was still a bohemian lifestyle. Grants, small pockets of bourgeois money, petty crime, hustling, and occasional labor in culture or elsewhere." So forward 3 years now to 1961. By this time, the Situationist International is an international organization, worthy of its name. And they're giving a public talk at London's Institute of Contemporary Art. Bear in mind the kind of class makeup of these people when I tell you this story, okay? So this is a kind of mixed event. You've got art students, you've got intellectuals, and then you've just got kind of ordinary working class people. And when they finish their kind of ranting, which is very obscure for anyone who's ever read any Situationist stuff, I still don't understand it. This guy asked a very reasonable question that I don't know the answer to. I'm 3 years at art college reading this stuff. Don't know the answer to this question. What is Situationism? The SI co-founder, Guy Debord, replies, "We're not here to answer cuntish questions." At which point, him and all of the Situationists walk out in disgust. About the same time, and a little bit after this, they come into contact with a libertarian socialist group that's called Socialism or Barbarism. And the working class at this point become less of a kind of abstraction and more of a kind of viable means to achieve their revolutionary artistic goals. And they, at this point, they're kind of in the council communist tradition. They see themselves in the tradition of Kronstadt 21, Catalonia 36, and Budapest as a kind of working class opposition to both Stalinism and capitalism. That's the Situationist International. So let's skip forward now to 1968. So there's lots going on, as the other speakers have gone into. We've got the war in Vietnam, we've got the Prague Spring, so these kind of democratic reforms, which are then met with USSR repression. You've got the occupation of Hornsey Art College in London, followed by kind of lots of occupations all over the UK at that time. And you've also got the campaign for nuclear disarmament is at its height. And lots of arrests from their activities. So France, 1968. Monday, May the 6th. So following a wave of student protests against issues like class discrimination, sexual repression, and university bureaucracy, there's a complete ban on demonstrations, and the closure of large sections of central Paris brings over 20,000 angry students onto the streets. The crowd begins to create barricades. According to one eyewitness, literally thousands helped. Women, workers, people in pajamas, human chains to carry rocks, wood and iron. The police respond with tear gas and charge the crowd. Hundreds were arrested. Tuesday, May the 5th, a 50,000-strong march against police brutality turns into a day-long battle. The police fire tear gas. The protesters answered with Molotov cocktails. The protesters at this point chant, "Long live the Paris Commune." Saturday, May the 11th, this is when the Situationist and Letterist slogans begin to be sprayed on walls. So you've got, "Be realistic, demand the impossible. Beneath the paving stones, the beach. All Power to the Imagination. And this one makes me laugh. The most beautiful sculpture is a paving stone thrown at a cop's head. So now and only now, the French Communist Party and the major union federations, both of whom had previously condemned the actions, call a one-day general strike and demonstration for Monday, 13th of May. Well over a million people marched through Paris. Prime Minister Georges Pompidou personally announced the release of prisoners and the reopening of the Sorbonne. The reopening of the Sorbonne is immediately reoccupied by students who declare it a people's university. Okay, bear with me. It's like a roller coaster of history. Let's go. So workers, Tuesday, May the 14th, workers lock management in their offices at the Sud Aviation plant. All over France, more workers begin occupying factories and striking. Wednesday, May the 15th, that night, the National Theatre in Paris was seized and made into a permanent assembly for public debate. So back to the artist. The theatre's director, who's this kind of like old, sort of slightly camp theatre guy, absolutely loves this. And he's got this guy, there's a video on YouTube of him calling this the theatre of real life. He's got all these kind of workers flooding into his theatre. And it's a great moment for him. Roughly 50 factories are occupied by now. 200,000 workers were now on strike. So same day, May the 17th, members of the Situationist International found the Council for the Maintenance of the Occupations, which is a really very successful exercise in direct democracy, at least for 2 weeks or something. this CMDO is organised into three committees. You have the printing committee, which is for writing and printing their publications, and they're printing using printing presses that have been occupied by the workers of the printing presses. And then you have this liaison committee. They somehow get hold of 10 cars, and they contact, this is for kind of contacting with the other factories. And you have the requisitions committee, and they make sure that things like toilet paper, petrol, food, money, kind of cigarettes, you know, these are French people in 1968. It's a cigarettes, wine is never lacking, looting kind of stuff. You know, this is how they, you know, supply these revolutionaries. So Saturday, May the 18th, 2 million workers are on strike. Monday, May the 20th, 10 million are on strike. That's roughly 2/3 of the French workforce. The Communist Party, back to their old tricks, urged their members to try and stop the revolt. The unions tried to kind of channel this through a struggle into one for higher wages. The workers, however, demand the ousting of the government and President de Gaulle and continue to attempt to run their factories. The unions negotiate a package of economic reforms. The workers reject this and refuse to go back to work and jeer their union leaders. May the 24th, the Paris Stock Exchange is set on fire by protesters. Army generals readied 20,000 troops to take hold of Paris with force. The Communist Party officials start to manipulate the strikers into returning to work. So they tell one group of workers in a train station, oh, such and such a group has gone back, you know, you should go back. And then they go over and tell the other train workers, oh, these workers have gone back. And they start trying to get everyone kind of back into the fold. Friday, May the 25th, further offers are rejected as inadequate by the workers. The strike keeps on going. Wednesday, 30th of May, 400,000 to 500,000 people march through Paris. Thursday the 31st of May, while the government appeared to be close to collapse, de Gaulle remains firm. He gets assurances from the military that it was still loyal to him, and he goes on the radio because the TV workers are on strike. He's forced to do, you know, go to the radio, and announced the dissolution of the National Assembly with elections to follow on the 23rd of June. He threatens to institute a state of national emergency and orders workers to return to work. And now this is like the real depressing bit. So, Tuesday, some of you will know the story already. Sorry to take you through this again. Most workers have gradually returned to work or were ousted from their plants by the police. The National Student Union called off street demonstrations. The government bans a number of leftist organisations. June the 6th, the police retook the Sorbonne. De Gaulle triumphed in the legislative elections held later in June and was actually elected with an even bigger majority than he had previously. The crisis comes to an end. So, how long have I got?
1 minute.
1 minute, okay, perfect, right. So I'll try and get a quick conclusion in there then. Thank you, Rev. I hope people picked up on some of that. That was quite quick. So I think the most important thing to note is that it took the working class, not the unions, not the French Communist Party, to realise a small semblance and a small and defeat semblance of Marx's demand that instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, we inscribe on our banners the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wages system. the SPGB as an organization, we have a lot in common with the Situationists and the kind of ideals of 68. We have an equal hatred of Stalinists. We're critical of pseudo-socialism and state capitalist regimes like the USSR. Let's try and not have a real tiresome debate about whether the state comes from Bismarck, but anyway. Well, we can. Let's have it. Yeah, come on. We take seriously Marx's statement that the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class itself, and we therefore reject these kind of Leninist ideas of avant-garde. But as an SPGB, I think one of the fundamental distinctions between the Situationists and the SPGB is over the proper ordering of practice and theory and action and organization. The Situationists really emphasize this kind of like sporadic, get on the streets and just do stuff, which is kind of all well and good, but always seems to end in kind of defeat. We also believe in the need, of course, not to leave state power in the hands of the capitalist class. So this is summed up quite well, and I'll kind of end on this by Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who was a big guy involved in the Paris uprisings, has this interview with Sartre, where Sartre says, "What many people cannot understand is the fact that you have not tried to work out a program or to give your movement a structure, and they attack you for trying to smash everything without knowing what you would like to what you would like to put in place or what you want to demolish." And he answers, the movement's strength is precisely that it's based on an uncontrollable spontaneity, that it gives an impetus without trying to canalize it or use the action it had unleashed to its own profit. And I kind of agree on one level. I'm also a member of the IWW, by the way, so I'm quite sympathetic to these ideas. But I'm kind of like a schizophrenic between like being an IWW member and an SPGB member. And I'm working on it. But I would also say that it's kind of its strength. And I hope we get to have a kind of discussion about this, because I think it's an important question. You know, whether do ideas precede revolution? Does revolution kind of give birth to ideas? And of course, the answer is kind of dialectical, right, I think. So that's pretty much that. I can give you kind of more later on, but I think I've run out of time. Thank you. I hope you got some information from all of that. Cheers.
Hi. Welcome. So, speaking of Daniel Cohn-Bendit, I was in Paris in 1999, I think it was. And I brought, Cohn-Bendit was at this meeting of the European Parliament with the Greens. And being a Green representative of sorts, I stress of sorts because it wasn't official, from New York, I gave Cohn-Bendit, who was about to do TV shows everywhere, he's very famous, Free Mumia Abu Jamal button. And I said, please put it on for the TV. And he said, oh, thank you very much. And he put it in his pocket. So I said, no, put it on, the idea, so people will see it and talk about it. And he said, he just put it in his pocket, and then that was the last I saw of him, or the button. So there's something, transformation that happened in his mind. For me, 1968 is, as Rudy Deutschke said, the long march through all the institutions of society. And that's what we've been doing starting then, and we continue to do that. All the way through to today, I don't think it was a failure. I agree with Abdul very much. It wasn't a failure at all. We're still pursuing the same idea of transforming the institutions of our lives, right? So I took a ride on the way down here. We came down by taxi cab, which I hardly ever do, but we're up on the northern part of Chicago, about not that far north, but 12 miles or so. And the driver of the car was a young woman in her 30s, originally from Mexico. And we got to talking, and I was telling her, I was saying, wow, I haven't been in Chicago in a long time. I said, well, you know, this is where we were tear gassed in 1968, right here on Michigan Avenue, and the cops beat the living hell out of us, right? And then I was pointing, oh, this is where this happened, and this is where that happened. And it was all coming back to me, which things I had forgotten about from years and years ago. And it was pretty exciting being here. She had no idea what I was talking about. She had no idea of the history. She was in her mid-30s. She said, at one point she said, ah, yes, my dad mentioned there was a protest here. And if she doesn't get it, if she doesn't know that, I'm not blaming her in any way at all. If she doesn't know that history and therefore is not able to make conclusions from integrating that history into her own life, then it's on us. We have that problem. We have that problem of figuring out, it seems to me, how it is that overall society becomes cognizant of all of these issues, discusses these issues. We talked about socialism earlier today in one of the sessions. Well, how does the mass movements, how do they develop socialism? Is it a lightning bolt that just happens? If we lecture people hard enough about it, you must be a socialist. Will they become a socialist then? So I wanted to talk about some of that in this talk and in the discussion. And I always like to start with Steve Biko's great quote that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And remember that. Do people know who Steve Biko was? Anybody who doesn't, don't be shy, because this is our education system. Steve Biko was a South African revolutionary who was fighting. He was eventually killed, but he was talked about the Black Liberation Movement inside South Africa and what strategic stages of struggle it needed to go through so that Black people and white people in South Africa would be able to fight on equal terms on the same side. And he also was eventually murdered in prison, in a dungeon, by electric cattle prods sold to or given to the South African government by the United States. So that too is on us to stop that, in my view. Not that we did it, but we didn't stop it. And we need to be cognizant ourselves of all of our own government, even though we're not part of the government, but our own government's actions all around the world. And that's part of what the New Left was about in the 60s. It was about fighting against imperialism and putting imperialism back on the agenda of that had been stripped from it from the old left, as we saw it. As the old left gradually went on, that was not there at all. Vietnam War, yeah, was there, but it wasn't in terms of imperialism, of capitalism developing around the world. And it was a huge moral question for us. It was a huge, do we fight against the war? Okay, it's immoral what this country is doing, just like it's doing today in Sudan and in every Syria and in just every country, you name it, what this country is doing. It's not this people of this country, it's the ruling class of this country is doing to these other people all around the world. And so what is our responsibility and our opportunity? It's not a guilt trip, it's, wow, we have this amazing opportunity to save the world in a way. And will we rise up to that challenge? So that's where I'm coming from, and that's part of the legacy of the New Left, I feel, that we need to do, and we need to carry forward. So, yeah, I want to say something that might be a little controversial, that I don't believe that people are poor. I don't believe people are poor. How many people here believe people are poor? Just because I said it over.
People are poor.
Right.
There are poor people in the world.
Yeah. People, I will argue that people are not poor. People are made poor. There's some active force that's making the situation the way it is, that's taking power away from people, that's impoverishing people, that's destroying the environment. It's not, oh, the trees are dying, or the ozone layer is collapsing, or you know, the environment is, the planet's on its last leg, so to speak, or human life on the planet is in desperate state. There's people behind it. There's forces, not only people, forces, organized forces that are doing these things. And we have the responsibility and the opportunity to stop it. How do we do that? And that's the question before us, I think. I'm going to jump around a lot, too, because of the New Left, because Che Guevara was a big influence on a lot of the New Left. And I'm not talking about the parties that came out of the left, the Maoist parties and the other parties. Some good ideas in there, but a lot of bad, in my view, a lot of bad ways of organizing and of Stalinism in a way of sorts. But Che Guevara talked about the need to build a new human being, in the course of struggling for the revolution, that we have to transform ourselves and our social relations and the way we relate to everyone around us while we go about trying to change the world. That you have to do both at the same time, or it won't work. We won't succeed. Even if you don't like the idea, you have to figure out what's going to succeed and what's not. So, my own view is that there has to be direct action communities of resistance and nurturance around the world and what we do, and that those communities form. Well, I'll give you an example. Black Panther Party set up free breakfast for children programs. We all heard about that. It was sort of dismissed earlier today in a certain context, not that specific program, but the idea that these are sort of Salvation Army type programs or you know, and that's really not socialist. And the idea is that we have to begin organizing ourselves to meet people's needs to the extent that we can, and through those actual institutions that we create and that mass movements create, through that socialism breeds. Through that we have the fight against, like in Long Island, and where I work with Black Panther Party in Riverhead, and so did Robin a little bit, in building the Free Breakfast for Children program there, and we built a medical clinic, and we built a number of projects that are very real for people and for ourselves, because we were part of the desperate people who needed the medical care. So we built this, and the state came in and said that, and then they tried to shut it down. So we organized the community to defend their and our clinic and their and our breakfast program. And thousands of people got involved in this movement. And when we organized this, so then they came in and said, well, you only have one sink, and you need, the law says you need three sinks. And that's their excuse that they gave for shutting it down. So we brought in another sink. So they found another reason, right? And we did something else, and they found another reason, because they wanted to shut it down. They didn't want children being fed in the morning so that they could learn and go to school and develop into leaders and develop their intelligence. So we did that in Long Island, and the whole community got mobilized behind it. And in the course of that struggle, all of us, or the core group, were revolutionary. We considered ourselves revolutionary radicals. We talked about socialism all the time. I can't remember a moment when we didn't. But it wasn't in the abstract. It wasn't in throwing it at people. It was through the course of the institutions that we and the mass movement together built together. So there's the dialectic, as Abdul was saying, is really crucial. I agreed almost totally with everything you said, except for one part, which we'll talk about later. It's not important, that part. And I can feed a better straight line, right? So the question of how does socialism come about? How do people develop a socialist perspective so that they want socialism? And then the question goes to, let's suppose everybody in the world wants socialism. Everybody in our movements. And then what? How does it come about? Will it happen magically? Will Rockefeller and the Koch brothers and all these capitalist rulers, are they going to allow it to happen? Will it happen in the way that a lot of us in the New Left back in the 60s thought, through armed insurrection? Will it happen in a different way? That was left out of the old left, it seemed to me. The how. What is the process by which a socialist revolution will come about? And that platypus could play a great role in also. So my time is actually off. I'm just starting. So I just wanted to thank my driver who drove down here and caused me to think about all this stuff, who didn't know about any of this. And we got to talking, and I just very much appreciate it. One more thing. People have read Marcuse, who was very influential in the New Left in the 60s. And Marcuse, his one of his most famous books that we were all reading in our collective at the time, Redwood Collective, out at Stony Brook University, was One Dimensional Man. And that was like the most depressing book, aside from being the most poorly written book, but it was one of the most depressing books you could ever read. Because he said, and many of us agree with him, that it's hopeless that the working class and its leadership are so bought off by capitalism that it's hopeless that our brains are being taken over, like aliens are taking over our brains. And we can't even think anymore. So Platypus has a real function in that way to get people and ourselves to think. But so some of us actually tied his book to bricks and then threw it through windows where we go to Ryerson because we thought it was a nice irony talking about the situation to use the most depressing book possible to just make a revolution or what we thought was a step in the revolution towards that process. Anyway, thanks.
Panelists now have 3 to 4 minutes to respond to one another.
I have a couple of quick points. First, I think that making judgments about history on the basis of the imagined goal that we think history is heading toward is a fundamental idealist position. A materialist position looks at the actual historical forces that developed. Maybe what happens is what we ought to study, not what we think ought to have happened. Particularly, this is the error that young people make, that we made. So for example, if you look at the 1960s and you look at what happened out of SDS, was that a failure? Was the October League and the Revolutionary Union, were they failures, or were they developments of Marxism at the end of the industrial period? So when the League of Revolutionary Black Workers develops out of black power, not as a failure, but as revolutionary politics on the factory floor for the first time since the 1930s. This was objectively true. It didn't happen in any other way. Now, that was in effect the end of the factory system. We were operating out of a third international perspective, make every factory a fortress. That's over. The technological revolution has ended the big factories as the basis for organizing resistance to capital. So that when we talk about things, we have to put it in a materialist sense in the context of history. And so we have to watch out for people making judgments about history without analyzing what actually happened. What actually happens might be in the realm of the possible. So to be a leftist, to be a Marxist, you cannot think about what you imagine to be true. You have to analyze the historical forces as Marx did, as Lenin did, as Mao did, in the context of those revolutions. So for example, if you take this notion of identity politics in black people, how convenient for white people to dismiss the reality of America. Those of you not from the United States, this is like South Africa. Look around, you don't see any black people sitting here, but if you go to the Pew survey, this is a big survey of the public opinion of the United States, the most committed people to socialism, over half, are black people. No other demographic group has that level of anti-capitalist view, pro-socialist view, than the African-American community, which comes out of the particularity of racism and the class struggle that has taken place. So, rather than what we imagine to be true, let's deal with the facts of the actual struggle that's happening in this society. If we're going to have a revolutionary movement, we're going to have to deal with the reality of the working class, not the way we imagine them to be, or a small group wants to imagine the revolution. It's the working class that's going to make the revolution, and poor people who are now systematically divorced from the productive forces of Silicon Valley. We have new questions to deal with.
Okay. First of all, the direct response to that, I don't feel that I'm projecting. I look at all the different aspects of the New Left and try to understand where each of them were coming from. I don't agree with any of them, but I do think that some of them were more viable than others. And so
could you define viable?
That in retrospect, it seemed like it was a more considered position, right? I do think that, with respect to the Black Power movement, I do think that Bayard Rustin had a point that needed to be considered. I also don't blame proponents of the Black Power movement for what they pursued, and it's not like I thought they were doing it wrong or something. Rather, I try to understand what was happening and why it was happening, and what might be considered in order, what could have been considered in a particular historical movement moment in order to change that the course of history. And of course, that's a matter of judgment, and that's something we all have to exercise. I understand that that the Black Power movements of the late 60s and early 70s were trying to turn the asset, the liability of the fact that they were essentially kept out of the left for so long and didn't have an actual place in the Democratic Party after that realignment strategy took place, and were trying to turn it into an asset and trying to make something of the discontent with that situation. That said, ultimately the whole thing seems like a tragedy, and I don't think there was much of an opportunity, unfortunately, in it. Could it take that route in the future? Perhaps. I certainly don't think that any socialist organization, or rather a mass socialist party, would be able to be successful in the United States without actually dealing with the problem of racism. Or rather, the fact that you know, yeah, the problem of racism. Now, you said that
Mitchell.
Mitchell, sorry. You said that we, the New Left, are still transforming the institutions.
No, the mass movements are.
The mass movements. Is the goal still revolution? And if so, maybe you can tell us how that is going to play, right? What about the mass movements is actually revolutionary? With respect to, like, how the organization of revolution has happened in the past, how does it actually deal with the problem of the old left or the new left? Since they both, the organization that Abdul is talking about is obviously very different from what you're talking about. Simply going through the institutions and mass movements, there's much more of a cadre building, party building element here. And also, and let me know how you disagree. It seems to me that in attempting to transform the institutions, the New Left ultimately ended up liquidating itself. What about building our own institutions? The Socialist Party that I mentioned was itself, they attempted to build these civil society, these institutions in civil society on the model of the SPD. Is that a viable option? Because I think it's like the question, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, the question of the Keynesian Fordist state sort of necessitated an approach towards entering the institutions. Ultimately, that came into crisis with neoliberalism and was no longer viable. And so I don't know how that problem, the fact that these institutions are themselves being destroyed, changes that argument. And I was hoping you could say more about, talk more about, like, that sort of problem of the IWW. And its relationship to sort of like the question of like, the split being there, right, already in American, early American politics between a workers' movement that was perhaps as a consequence of being divorced from the Socialist Party in the United States, gravitated towards this anarchism, or whether you disagree with that or how you see that problem.
Sure.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, sure, yeah, I'll try and get to that. I'm talking now, by the way, as an IWW member of the Socialist Party, and a Situationist. So let's see how this all works together without me just kind of exploding. Okay, so one distinction I'd like to make in response to kind of all of the speakers is a distinction between two different types of reformism, okay? When we talk about reformism, let's try and kind of like narrow this down. It strikes me there's two kind of distinct types, okay, of things that could both be called reformism. The first is the direct action of the working class, okay? And this would include things like unions, classic example. Also things like the Black Panther Free Breakfast Program. There's a lot of what was obviously going on in May 68 in Paris. And this is the kind of, you know, the grassroots self-organization of the working class to meet just demand basic needs within capitalism. In other words, like, they're not kind of like fully fledged, you want to abolish money, socialists. They're just kind of workers responding to their circumstances, but they're doing so in a direct grassroots way, okay? And reformism, which in the second sense, which for me is placing political and economic power into a bourgeois political party. That is to say, whatever its kind of pretenses of being a Labour Party, of being a revolutionary party, a party that seeks to control and administer the wages system, that's to say, it seeks to control and administer the exploitation of the working class and using state power, okay, to do so. This strikes me as a very important distinction to be made between these two things. So we're going to talk about reformism, you know, as just a kind of general term for any kind of thing other than full-on blown revolution that takes place within capitalism. So I'd like to make some distinction there. And obviously, as a member of the Social Party of Great Britain, we're incredibly sympathetic to the former and have in our own Declaration of Principles, which I don't have with me, a full hatred of the latter, which I think has it summed up in the Declaration. I've got another SPG bill with me. What's the Declaration of Principles? We're hostile to all other political parties, whether allegedly Labour or avidly capitalist, okay? So these kind of like, and then the reason I make this distinction, the reason I think this distinction is really important is because one, because this kind of bourgeois reformism, I think infantilizes the working class. I think that it takes the kind of, the working class, let's imagine the working class is kind of like teenagers, like they're coming of age, they're trying to make their own mistakes. That's the kind of good sort of reformism, if you want to call that. I prefer to call it direct action or something like that. But this kind of other party reformism infantilizes the working class. It's Daddy Corbyn, Daddy Sanders, you know, saying, hey, you know, just put your faith in me and I can make everything okay. Sure, the wages system is screwed, but put me in charge and everything will be okay. No. Bullshit. We've seen that time and time again. The working class ought not to fall for it. And I'd sooner have headless chickens in the working class running around chucking things through windows than I would them voting for these imposters. Okay, so that's a distinction I'd like to make. If someone can have my time, if they want to make my point.
Okay, so I would like to have two. I'll put to the vote here. I would like to respond. I forgot your name.
Joseph.
Excuse me?
Joseph.
Joseph, what Joseph was saying, or I have a poem that I would also like to read, and they're both in the same time. So, how many would like to hear a response?
A response.
How many would like to hear a poem?
Oh, let him say it.
Honestly, you want to do the poem. Oh, goodbye, poem. I don't know. What did Emma say?
I'd like to hear a response to me, and I want to hear what you disagreed with over here.
Yeah. That was a minor thing. It's just about the weather on the ground.
Oh, okay.
So when we concoct demands, right, we're all involved, I assume, in being part of movements or groups that make demands. We trap ourselves into the state, making it similar to what you were just saying, about making demands on the state and then getting co-opted and then moving. But we rarely think of what that means direct action-wise. Direct action, by that, I do not only mean being militant in the streets. It means that creating demands and institutions and ways of thinking that we put into effect by ourselves while we demand it of the system and of the state, knowing that the system is not going to do most of them, right? So, for instance, Food Not Bombs is a really good example, right? Have people been involved in Food Not Bombs? Mm-hmm. Nobody? So, obviously, we're not going to be able to, through our, like, 100 groups or 200 groups around the United States and some in Germany, we're not going to be able to feed all the people that need to be fed, or even a thousandth of those people. But what we can do is begin the operation of feeding people good, and where I was involved in California a little bit, organic food. That was dumpster dive, but it was still organic. That was an important consideration. To feed people and ourselves and feed our movement, but at the same time, we demand that the system provide this for people so that we fight for the demand that we're raising, but we start implementing it now so that communities rally around it, so that becomes the transitional mechanism. It's not an abstract Trotskyist transitional demand. It's actual building it in the concrete so that it becomes the new thing that we fight for. We fight not just for the abstract question that people should be fed. We fight fund these institutions and make these institutions the society. Same thing with the Black Panther Party programs. Same thing with a lot of, I mean, just everything. So I'd like us to think, I mean, we need to practice because we're not trained this way, to think about how we can begin implementing for ourselves whatever it is that we're demanding, even though we know we're not going to be able to do it fully at all in the society, as a means for getting to the point of achieving it and building a movement that fights for something in the concrete rather than an abstract demand. And that's where I, how I was addressing sort of sideways, but trying to address what Joseph was saying. At the same time, it's really good to have fun with transforming just the world around us too. I mean, revolution is fun, even though we're going to, a lot of us are going to die, but it's still fun. If it stops being fun, then we should find another planet to live on. It's fun fighting for freedom.
Yeah, I guess we'll move into the question and answer portion now. Okay, back there.
Yeah, Mitchell, going off of what you just said, I think there's a lot of sense to that model of a transitional demand. And I guess I'm just wondering, when you or others in the movement set out on that long march through the institutions, why was it that that was done in and through the existing capitalist state and the Democratic Party? In other words, why not do it on the basis of a new and different political party? Because it seems like what actually happened was that empowered the Democratic Party.
Good question.
How are we working this? Are we all answering it?
Whoever wants to take it can answer.
Well, I'll take it.
I agree with the guys.
It's funny, we've been actually talking about this. I agree with you totally. I'm not saying to work with the Democratic Party in the slightest. We set up indie media. We set up our own media set up. We set up our own health clinics. We set up whatever we can. That's the whole point, is set up independent. But that people who, regardless of who they vote for, can then take part in the building of those projects in their communities and take part in it regardless of where they are. And then help them and help ourselves transform what we think about and our ideas of socialism so that it doesn't remain an abstract. It remains, this is socialism, we're building this.
And just to follow up, when it gets to the point of the state actually intervening to support those programs, what happens then if there's no independent political party with which you're aligned?
I like to think we'll burn that bridge when we come to it.
Okay.
Because the state doesn't do that, right? Hardly ever.
Yeah, but
and
I think
if it does, it means that we're winning because we're powerful enough to force that to happen.
See, there's another aspect of this, which is the fact that, you know, when I said that politics is the art of the possible, the question is, what is the state of the working class? And in this country, the third parties have been co-opted in the expansion of democracy. So if you take, let's take Chicago politics as an example. The democratic machine operated in a particular way that advanced the industrialization of the city with all the contradictions of capitalism. The question is, how do you expand democracy to the point where people would actually challenge not only the political system, but the economic system as well? When Harold Washington was elected, a lot of people on the left stood aside and condemned the election because it was electing a Democrat. as opposed to understanding it was expanding democracy, which is the basis on which a lot of radical consciousness happened among the masses of people, which was not happening among the small groups on the left that were condemning it, but the working class was learning about the political system and being against the daily machine. Now, of course, Harold died, and the democratic machine reasserted itself. But now we have, for example, the Latino, who's emerging and critiquing the political system. So the question I raise is, how do we take ourselves outside of the historical motion of the working class and leave the opportunity to teach the working class in the context of what they think is possible in order for their consciousness to make the leap to actually then challenge the system that we think they should be challenging initially, but their experience doesn't lead them to do that. Now, in Germany, for example, as I understand it, the 68 generation went into the school system, out of which came the Green Party. Now, the question for all the young people here is, what are you all going to do? Most of you all are going to get jobs and go to work somewhere, as opposed to becoming full-time cadre in the revolutionary movement. That's really what he was talking about when he said the long march to the institutions. You have a job, and you then spend some time trying to organize people around revolutionary ideas, but most of it is the politics of everyday life. That's where the working class is, the politics of everyday life. In other words, your kids being educated in the public schools, your healthcare system, your streets and sanitation. That's where the actual struggles take place. Bread, peace, and land. That's what the Soviets were talking about. Real experience of the working class. If you make the revolution an abstraction and you think that's where you're going to live, you're going to become religious about it and sit in groups like you're in church, as opposed to be part of the actual history of the working class. We're here at the University of Chicago. What is the analysis of the University of Chicago in relationship to the class struggle in this city? Now, in the 1960s, we discovered the University of Chicago was a racist landlord with exclusionary contracts, and we fought against that. That was a real struggle. Now, we were also dealing with Milton Friedman and the economics department here, and his Ed Levy and Julian Levy, the two brothers that were running the city and the university. We were struggling against them in the concrete. Now, when you all go back home, what are you going to do? What is the concrete struggle you're going to be involved in so that you can theorize about how the working class can make a revolution? We're not going to make a revolution. You are not going to make a revolution. The working class and poor people are, and you have to serve them. That's the real point, it seems to me. And summing up their experience and giving their experience back to them, that's what Marx did. He summed it up to give it back to the working class. And it seems to me that's what we have to do. If we don't do that, we're actually thinking we are the revolutionaries that are going to make the revolution. And I'm here to tell you, this guy, we've been in this a while. We haven't made a revolution. It hasn't because we haven't tried. You all are going to try. But it's only if you unite with the working class. That is the point. And their consciousness is what defines history. Their activity is what defines history. I wish it was different. I wish it was magical. But it's not. Biko could be condemned for identity politics. The people who organized the women's movement could be condemned for identity politics. These are revolutionary impulses. Anyway, you know, something to think about.
You're in the way?
Oh, wait.
Oh, sorry. Okay, never mind.
This question of the working class, and perhaps to get more back to IWW, that problem. '68 was the 50th anniversary of the German Revolution and its failure. In the lead up to that, there was a vocal, of course, we all know, a vocal dismissal or rather, there was an argument within the German Socialist Party, within the SPD, about the nature of the problem that was allowing the party to tend towards reformism. And, you know, Panikowicz was perhaps one of the more eloquent on the matter, and talked about this problem that always that existed also in the other socialist parties, of there being, of the party essentially coming to represent element of the working class that was more petty bourgeois, that was skilled workers, intellectuals, that it wasn't sort of like bringing in the industrial workers that were actually suffering, right? Like this argument, on the other end of the revolution, when you have Zinoviev bringing it up, descends into a mere sociological problem. And it's like, what we need is a party of the poorest of the poor workers. Rather than understanding, as Panikowicz did, as Rosa Luxemburg did, as Lenin did, that, of course, the party is going to have all these petty bourgeois elements, so to speak. And in some cases, they are going to be the most revolutionary. That the problem wasn't sort of the sociological composition of the party, but the politics that allowed the party to align itself with bourgeois parties in 1905, right? It's not merely a matter of like the poorest of the poor versus the more bourgeoisified, right? It's the matter of people who work and people who don't, but it also is a matter of like the politics of that, right?
Just quickly, because I know other people want to speak, but it strikes me that the reason political parties, and this is the history of the German Social Democrats, but all the Social Democrats in Europe, the Labour Party, these parties that want to be revolutionary and reformist, the reason that they always end up reformist is because as soon as they get elected, they have to deal with the runnings of capitalism. They just become a capitalist party, and they have to deal with the interworkings of capitalism. Capitalism can only be run in one way, and that's in the interest of the capitalist class on the basis of the accumulation of capital. Invariably, all these parties, you know, you look at 1945 in Britain, okay, Clement Attlee, the great hero of Corbyn and the left, this guy used the army 18 times he used the army to crush the working class, okay, during that's during 6 years, that's like three times a year, for fuck's sake, okay? Now, this is the reality of trying to be a reformist party and a revolutionary party. You invariably just become a revolutionary party. On the other hand, if you look at it from the other way around, if you look at wherever you see, whether it's through this kind of like slightly sporadic, unclass conscious, but just like kind of direct action approach, or in terms of the growth of an actual class consciousness in a political party, that's when you see reforms being granted. And reforms are granted by the state regardless of what party is in power. When there's a growing revolutionary working class, the reforms are chucked towards the workers. So if you want reforms, you should go for the most revolutionary party possible. If you want reforms, then you should take a direct action approach of demanding those reforms. If you want... And you also might get revolution out of it, okay? So revolutionary organizations get reforms, okay? Reformist organizations don't get revolution. That's important to remember, I think.
Yeah, so my comments are just addressed to two of you on the panel, to Joseph and to the comrade from the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And it's striking to me that you're the two people on the panel from representing listings, representing some entities with the word socialist party in them. But both of you seem to give a somewhat schizophrenic presentation about your relationship not only to the idea of a party, but to politics in general. So on the one hand, the comrade from the Socialist Party of Great Britain, you speak about, like you praise, like what seems to be merely street theater where people go into some French Catholic celebrated mass and disrupted. I mean, whether you like that or you don't like that, I don't really see how that has much political content or what that has to do with building socialism. And then you praise the kind of quasi-spontaneous movement of the French masses, and you admit that this is a failure, right? Obviously, May 68 didn't overthrow the French state. Mm. And presumably, the only way it could have overthrown the French state would have been an organized political party in which those workers were united. In other words, precisely the Leninist tradition that you would seem to reject. Because you're, okay, And then in Joseph's case, on the one hand, you of the four people in the panel are the one who is most cynical and pessimistic about 1968, you're basically negative on the whole legacy of the new left. And you speak about the problems actually going back further all the way to 1848. And then you sort of end with this sort of optimistic appeal to a campaign, what we need now is a mass socialist party. So again, like the question is, it felt like there's this discrepancy in this mood between this profoundly pessimistic narrative of maybe a century and three quarters of defeat, and then saying, well, now I'm going to go out and let's try to build a mass socialist party to organize the working class. And I'm wondering how you sort of, like, go from one step to the other in the narrative. So, I mean, this one narrative seemed to me highly apolitical and then appeals to politics in some sense. And in the end, you have an appeal to revolutionary politics to get reform. And the other is a narrative that's not apolitical, but profoundly conservative and pessimistic about the actual history of the Marxist left. And then seems to say, well, what we need is the mass organization of the working class. Okay, sorry.
Okay. Do you mind if I do?
Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So firstly, just quickly on the 1950 Easter Mass, I completely agree. I mean, I don't think if it sounded like I was trying to kind of track a history of the situation. It's okay. And you've got to bear in mind that by the 1960s, the situations themselves are making this criticism of the lecturers. And the point when the kind of just before 1968, where they become council communists, I consider this a very good development. Okay. When they're moving away from, as you quite rightly call it, street theatre. Or does anyone have like a new atheist cousin, like little cousin, who's a new atheist? It's like an infantile kind of teenage rebellion, you know, where it's like, oh, fuck God, God's a twat, isn't he? You know? I mean, no, like this is just like pathetic. You're quite right. I agree with that completely. Like, but that the lecturers in 1950 aren't the situationists by 1968. And so whilst there were good criticisms to be made of the situations by 1968, they themselves have moved away from the Easter Mass stuff of the 1950s. Okay, so that's the first thing. Secondly, I don't really see what, and I disagree with members of the Social Party of Great Britain on this, okay, but I don't see what the conflict is between a completely anti-reformist political party that seeks state power. And the reason it seeks power in state power in an anti-reformist way is because of all the dangers of reformism, right? That you become another party of capitalism, right? You run the wages system, and it can only be run in an oppressive way. Blah blah blah. Okay, that's the need for that party. I don't see what the big antagonism is with that and an organization like the IWW, first organization to allow black members, first organization to organize across trades, across, you know, when it was time when like only specialists and these were all kind of white male workers could be in a union, they organized across the entire class, were kind of routinely in street fights with the KKK because of it, beaten up by the boss. I don't see what the antagonism is between these two things. It strikes me that the only political organization that I'm possibly prepared to support is the Socialist Party of Great Britain. That's why I'm a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. In all other regards, I'm, yeah, street fighting anarchist. What's the problem? Maybe there is one, but yeah, it doesn't, not for me. But you know, I used the word schizophrenic before you did. So.
But I mean, for example, you spoke about like the end goal of being like the abolition of money, right? Mm.
Well, that's Marx, but yeah.
Right, but again, like to abolish money, first you'd have to abolish capitalism, right? And you'd have to like substitute some economic system. Right. I mean, even in the Bolshevik Revolution, it didn't abolish money, and it seems to me the abolition of money is the last and essentially a technical stage of something that follows a profound political and economic transformation of society. Mm. Right. And yet, like that goal sort of somehow is like again, it does seem to me that it's basically a kind of anarchist impulse that you're pushing, and then I kind of wonder, well, why? Like, where does the party fit in? Mm. Because it does sound to me like that's really what you are. You're an anarchist. And then why call yourself a member of something called the Socialist Party?
Well, because the Socialist Party of Great Britain does believe in using the democratic powers available to us to disband and take state power away from the capitalist class. That to us is the failure of 1936 in Spain, for example. You know, the fact that they were prepared to leave state power in the hands of Stalinists on one hand and fascists ultimately, who just massacred the whole lot. And that was a suicide on us of anarchism.
But if you take state power, you'd have to have a revolutionary state that you run.
I think that if you go with my kind of two coined approach, right, where you have a build up of workers' councils, industrial unionism, in other words, you have a new body of power ready, available out of the shell of the old, as we say in the IWW, and then you use a democratic power available, right, to take the kind of icing on the cake, which is potentially an oppressive state, to take that away from the capital class. This strikes me as the future of a revolution. So I'm really not speaking as I'm the Social Party of Great Britain purely, and they're going to fucking kick me out for this. but as a kind of somebody that's trying to kind of come up with some way of doing that, I think these are all good questions, by the way, and I don't claim to have a perfect answer for them. We'll talk more. Okay, I'll let other people.
Short answer. Well, first of all, I don't think I'm... I see the New Left as insufficiently Marxist. And the real question of the origins of the New Left is, how are you going to be a Marxist during the Cold War, right? And it's really, that's like where like the Shackmanite, the potential of a Shackmanite vision in the 30s and 40s, maybe even the 50s, has some sort of purchase, perhaps, but is in some way insufficient. Like, it's an attempt to deal with the Cold War, this third campism, right? I don't think it worked. Or it, like, there are like problems with it, and I could talk about that for a long time. But in any case, I'm trying to actually provide a critique of the New Left from actually the perspective of Marx and Lenin. and as to like the schizophrenic nature, I think that I don't know any way out of that. Just pessimism of the strong, baby.
It's dialectic.
I mean, it's just sort of like the pursuit. I'm trying to be fully cognizant of just how much of a barrier our current situation is, and deal with that without simply like washing over it and just like, you know, putting the blinders on and just like doing the activism without thinking. To some extent, I'm going to have to do it, and I do. You know, I like, you know, the leaflets and like the tabling and all of those things. I have to do that on like on a regular basis as an activist. Right, but I demand the right to be able to reflect on that.
I'm not sure what you mean by the New Left.
Mm-hmm.
When does that end? Or
well,
what
I mean,
are you
what
talking about?
I sort of like periodized it in terms of like, essentially, I think like the New Left is everything from the Cold War on. It's the new sort of like movements that emerge out of the Cold War. And everything that the sort of like that emerges in like the process of de-Stalinization and the collapse.
So there was something called the New Communist Movement.
Mm-hmm.
You call that the New Left.
They are part of the New Left, yes. Yes.
So the rebirth of Marxism.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it, yeah. Was itself like inadequately Marxist.
On what basis do you make that judgment?
I've liked several of the things that I said with respect to, for instance, the fallout of SDS is unfortunate precisely because it splinters into these sects that ultimately are either trying to reproducing forms of sectarianism, whether they're Maoist or Stalinist or Trotskyist, that harken back to a form of politics that ultimately cannot sort of like escape the gravity of Stalinism and of the problem of the failure of the Russian Revolution. I mean, there's no way, easy way of actually, go ahead.
See, what happened in SDS,
mm-hmm.
First there was this polarity between people who believe that progressives here should support the struggle in the national liberation organizations. Mm-hmm. So it was to support the Vietnamese struggle. The others were rediscovering Marxism. And so RIM II was that wing that then developed into these different formations. And these different formations then hooked up with people who had been purged from the CP and were part of the Provisional Organizing Committee, who held to a more revolutionary Marxist position against the history of Browderism. And what was rediscovered at that same time was the emergence of Marxism coming from the Third World, mainly China. And so the republication of Marxist texts came from foreign language press out of China and China books and from other places like India and so forth that had publishing operations. So suddenly now we had access to the texts. I don't think that's irrelevant.
It's not, no.
And so we then suddenly we're reading the texts and we're rethinking Marxist theory in relationship to the reality. So for example, with regard to the question of racism in the United States, we had the rediscovery of the national question. And so we read what the Soviets wrote about it. We read what the Chinese wrote about it. We took the Comintern's position and tried to understand the history of black people in this country. I don't think that's irrelevant. I think that's fundamental. And so that we developed Marxism as a viable body of thought in the United States for the first time since the 1930s. In other words, we had the fascist 50s and therefore the social democracy of Europe. We didn't have that here. You know, we had the FDR legacy of the New Deal, but we didn't have those profound social democratic tendencies that opened up. So in the 60s, certain things happened. But my point is that SDS or the New Left cannot be talked about as one thing. There were historical developments, and we stand on that. In fact, Platypus stands on that, whether Platypus understands that or not. In other words, you stand on history as it actually happened. That's my point. In other words, when Richard Flax and them wrote the Port Huron Statement that led to SDS, that was not irrelevant. That was a fundamental awakening of the youth. And then he came to this university. And so what I'm trying to say is, again, I like your point about reformism, but we have to fundamentally make a distinction between reform and revolution. If you don't understand that history is made by reforms, do you have children? Do they go to school? Are you concerned about what they learn in school? How about health care? Anybody got insurance? Anybody been sick lately? How about your mama? These are reforms. If you make a revolution, what do you think the next day is about? Reforms. And the reforms are only going to be possible to the extent that the working class will implement them. Take Cuba. What is Cuba about today? They have difficulty feeding themselves. You think a revolution can exist without people being fed? Reforms. Changes, in other words, changes in how the society is structured. It's a step-by-step process. Analyzing what the Soviets did. You're looking at reforms. How do you change the factory system? How do you change distribution? How do you change decision-making? You can call the word revolution all you want to, but in the real world, in the material world, you're talking about changes, and those changes are, in fact, reforms.
So I wanted to shift a little bit, but to answer this question in an oblique way, as is my wont, I think we need to also ask whether our goal has to do with the taking over the nation state. Is that what our goal is? Is that what the goal of revolutionary movements are or should be? And when in French uprising in 1968, there was a point made that it failed because it didn't take over the state. It didn't defeat the goal and become state power. But is that what people were aspiring to do in their own terms, even? Is that what they said they'd do? I think they failed. What part of it failed is when Cohn-Bendit and the others moved right on past the Bank of France and left all the gold sitting there where they had it in their hand, and they said, we don't need their stinking gold. And they would have had capitalism there at that time, which was dependent on that, by, you know, they would have had it, a pressure point to fight around, but they let it go. And after that, the revolution, I feel, got crushed. On the other hand, we have the Zapatistas in Mexico. And it's very, these are all very contradictory movements. I'm not saying there's one answer to them. In fact, I think if there's only one answer, then the question is wrong. But the Zapatistas are organizing and mobilizing for 20 years. What is it, 95 to, yeah, 23 years ago already. Around the idea that of making changes in civil society, of fighting for those changes, so that other things can be allowed to blossom without supporting any political parties, although now they are running their own candidate for the first time for national office. So we need to take in, I agree with what you're saying, the experiences, the real living experiences that exist, and there's so many different forms that it's taking, and build upon that and understand that and not try to unitarianize that, make that into one, not try to homogenize that into one thing forward. One just quick example of working class. We are the working class, part of the working class. That's it's not another, it's not other, it's us and people who we know and other people who we don't know, but that's, we're part of that. And so when, say, workers go on strike against Greyhound or against the train system or against that, our role is not only to support that strike, in my view, but also to say, to talk to people, whatever means we have. How would you reconstruct the transit system so that it stops in all people's neighborhoods? You know, how would you make it free for people to ride? I mean, in New York, we opened the gates at one point, and the transit workers supported us, and everybody rode for free for a couple of days, you know, or jumped the turnstiles or whatever. I mean, there was only a moment, but that moment allowed people to see that there was a possible different way of thinking and different way of functioning in this, or working in the society, of being, that never would have come to them without that movement, without that type of thing happening. So it's not just cause and effect. I mean, there are lots of things that happen in the course of struggles that you can't predict in ways, but we know that they happen because they always happen. And I'll just quote one more person. It's Freddie Perlman, who I used to love from Detroit, and he was a main theorist of the New Left. And he talked about how when people are oppressed, there are always, always ways of rebelling that people engage in, even if we don't see it. And our job is, conscious Marxists maybe, or as political people, is to search for and find those different ways of rebelling and do something with them, articulate them, put them out to people so that they become visible and they don't always remain invisible.
Yeah, I think our fear, those of us who are senior citizens, is that you're running out of time. The problems that you're facing are catastrophic, literally. And you don't have education. You've been given an education by the power elite, and you're uneducated. Your actual stupidity, your lack of knowledge is astonishing. I went to University of Wisconsin, and I took a course in revolution. And we studied revolutions from country to country. What do you know about the Venezuelan revolution? How all the power elite at that time taught the people, the working people, how to read. And how did they do it? They had a method that in 3 weeks the illiterate could learn to read. And what was the book? I mean, 12-year-old kids were out there teaching reading to adults. And the book they used was the Constitution. That's what happened there. What happened with the Civil Rights Movement was the northern whites went down and learned from the blacks down south and interacted with them and were with them. And do you know about every revolution? Have you studied them? Do you know what you have to do? And how much time do you have to do it in? Because every indication is that time is running out, literally. And I'm happy I'm not your age.
Okay. Oh, right, in the orange in the back.
Yeah, I've got two questions. So one was maybe a specific question for Abdul. Just in terms of the lessons of 1968 organization, you were bringing up an earlier history of the 50s before then, and that was read a piece by Richard Fraser, who advocates for revolutionary integrationism. And I guess from what you were saying, I was just a little unclear. You were talking about the need for us as Marxists to analyze material developments in society. Were you sort of saying then, in terms of like organizations that are kind of, I suppose my question is, by the time that kind of the Black Power movement took off, was there a kind of was the idea of a revolutionary integrationist organization no longer on the table for Black people? Was that the kind of or what happened there? Like, because in a sense the civil rights movement had been a kind of as well as being maybe a reformist movement, it was a kind of integrationist movement, and so I guess I'm just wondering, in terms of lessons to take forward for like the kind of organization necessary, how would that play out? And I guess broader than that is the question that sort of brought up about is about Marxism in general in 68 and the kind of obscure character of that. And we've seen kind of like different attempts to address what was the Marxism of 68, if any, or was 68 anti-Marxist? That's the kind of other question. Because in a sense, like some of the kind of politics that are coming from the SPGB has been articulating, in my view, I mean, if you really are an anarchist, then that's then you're not for Marxism. there's a difference, right? So what is the question of like political revolution for you? How does that play out? And just okay. As an anecdotal thing, just having met other members of the SPGB in Britain, obviously there's a difficulty now in terms of accessing the earlier history of, I mean, the SPGB is esoteric in itself within the broader movement within the broader history of socialist parties in its founding moment. But I think even for the membership now, the older members of the SPGB were also politicized around 68. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a kind of, that was their reason for joining the Socialist Party of Great Britain. So that's quite obscure.
Yeah.
Or it seems quite obscure to me. And on the other hand, maybe there's a way in which it appeals, the extent to which it is anti-Leninist.
Mm.
And so I guess this question about I'm not really sure, Mitchell, where you fit into the question of like political revolution. It sounds like you don't want to take power, maybe. So how do we render concrete what the Marxism of 1968 was, and is that desirable? Mm. Is that a desirable thing to kind of take forward?
Okay. Could you mind if I? Yeah, firstly, I'd like to make a serious distinction, which hasn't been made yet, between Marxism and Leninism, okay? Marx believed that the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class. Lenin believed in a vanguard political party of intellectuals, professional revolutionaries leading the working class. And he believed in this because he didn't believe that the working class could achieve anything other than trade union consciousness. He thought that the working class would come to a point where they just blocked, you know, and therefore they need this kind of like intellectual. And this is part of the reason that a lot of people today seem to be making a distinction between socialists and the working class. I don't make any such distinction. I'm a member of the working class and I'm a socialist. And it's to my fellow workers I address the socialist case. One of the fundamental questions I ask myself as a socialist is, how did I become a socialist? And I became a socialist through a combination of my experiences under capitalism, working in kitchens, trying to organize unions in kitchens, and coming into contact with the ideas of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. So again, I really don't see any distinction or any kind of antagonism between socialist propaganda, a socialist organization like the Socialist Party of Great Britain that says this, we stand for a moneyless, stateless society, and the class struggle and the trade union activity. There's never really been any antagonism as far as I can see. In regards to Abdul has this kind of idea that we of kind of analysing concrete material conditions. I think it's a very good thing to do. I would look at Lenin, look at Russia and look at China, and say, I think you fall into a trap of Marx warned us against judging a man by what he thinks of himself. And in other words, you look at the material conditions of what's going on in Russia based on what Lenin had to say about it. From a Marxist point of view, that is the number one thing you don't do, okay? You don't judge bourgeois society by the bourgeoisie. You don't judge a political ruling class by what those political ruling class people had to say about it. Look at Russia in 1917, okay? 80% of the population are peasants, right? There's a tiny minority, about 10% of workers that are revolutionary, okay? These are factory workers. The entire history of the supposed Bolshevik Revolution is the suppression of that tiny, tiny section of class-conscious workers. If you look at Kronstadt, massacre of those workers. Now, socialist revolution wasn't possible in Russia at that time. It wasn't possible, I can argue this on pure Marxist grounds, okay? It was a feudal society. It had to go through a capitalist stage of development. It went through that capitalist stage of development through kind of being dragged into it, basically, into a kind of state capitalist. And everything that followed with Stalin was dragging Russia out of being backwards feudal country into a modern industrial capitalist society. And everything that happened by the 80s and the 90s with the collapse of the Soviet Union, was it then just, you know, fully fledged coming of age as a capitalist organization? I mean, unless you really just look at Lenin and go, okay, yeah, well, you say you're a socialist, you say that you want all power to the Soviets. Doesn't matter that kind of like 2 years after declaring all power to the Soviets, you murder a shitload of workers and their Soviets. Then yeah, that's fine. But that's not judging material conditions, okay? Judge material conditions by the actual historical things on the ground. Russia wasn't ready for socialism. The number one thing, if you want any small, tiny fraction of a chance of achieving socialism in Russia, the number one thing you don't do is murder that tiny fraction of the working class that are taking control of their factories and organizing as class-conscious workers. Okay, so that's something I'd say.
The White Army murdered the working
class. Yeah, the White Army also murdered members of the working class. That's true. That's very true. Yeah.
Well, in this country, industrialization took place on the basis of slavery, so when we look at the world, we can imagine a different course of history, but we inherit what actually happened, and I think you're right, that we have to constantly try to get at what happened in order to have the knowledge we need. Mm. It seems to me that's a fundamental aspect of being scientific about history and about, you know, how we want to look at the future. Your point is a very interesting point about revolutionary integrationism. The problem is that what the civil rights movement accomplished was opening the society that enabled the black middle class to develop more fully. And the polarity that then resulted with the masses of poor black people being excluded. We all know the Brown decision of 1954, which was sort of the symbolic state decision to integrate society, that then took another year or so with the phrase all deliberate speed, which then never happened, was never implemented. So we never had integration. But we did have opening to some extent so that a middle class developed. Black power, particularly after suppression that took place, and symbolically that was the assassination of Malcolm X in 65, 66, black power develops, and it's really a class aspect of self-determination, which has two aspects to it. One is the fact that the civil rights movement actually was a movement in which white people acted as if they could still run it. Like the NAACP was historically run by white people. I mean, we would have meetings in this room, this very room, and white people would assume that if you're talking about black people, it's white people who are going to run the meeting. And so we went through a phase of putting white people out of the meeting, just like women went through a phase putting men out of the meeting. And so black power became what Malcolm called the organization of the bottom of the pile Negroes to form their own basis of power to fight against the state, to fight against the structures of racism, which are, after all, primarily the responsibility of white people. Because objectively, white people are the beneficiaries of racism, including all the radicals. All of you all are the beneficiaries of racism, just like people in Europe are the beneficiaries of the legacy of colonialism. And so black power represents the possibility. And historically in this country, it's when black people have moved that it wakes up and shakes up sections of the white working class and white people generally. And that's been the history. And so so black power is a class demand that fundamentally confronts structural racism. So today in this country, what is happening to this surplus, superfluous labor as a result of the technological revolution and the decline of the demand for labor in the workplace? They're murdering working class people in the street, and the first victims are black people. Now, in the high schools in the black community, they've had guns for years with metal detectors that you have to walk through to get into schools. But when white middle class people are impacted, and we have the March 24th demonstration, the ruling class is very aware that white people are waking up to the crisis. And so millions are poured into this movement. And The Guardian lets the high school editors take over the Guardian newspaper and talk. They're on TV, etc. Because they're making sure these middle-class white people get recruited to the University of Chicago, and they're going to be in all the elite schools, and they're going to have careers. But the reality for social change is whether or not those students connect with the inner city, the silenced ones in the society that are the brunt of the fascist attack. The unspeakable things that are happening to sections of the working class. That's really the challenge that we face. And right now, if Platypus has another international convention, and there are more of the oppressed people in this room, you all have to seriously ask yourself what the hell is going on here. If you really want to make a conversation that has revolutionary implications, and not just an academic exercise, in the most powerful ideas in the world, of course, but nevertheless, an academic exercise.
Okay. There's a gentleman up there that is yearning.
I think this will have to be the last question then. I think we're almost out of time, so if you guys could all respond and maybe wrap in some closing remarks.
So one thing that was raised but not really addressed other than with respect to the problem of Leninism, etc., is, and you know, it was addressed also obliquely with respect to the SDS and the New Left not being all one thing, is what was the actual political opportunity of the 1960s? In other words, like Abdul, you mentioned breaking with Browderism. Right, the old CP, you know, what that really meant. In other words, if there was a dissolution of a certain kind of reformism of an earlier time, then what was the actual character of the political opportunity of the 1960s? The party question was raised, I think, Richard asked the question of the two speakers who identify as members of a socialist party or would-be socialist party or something along those lines. But I would like to hear maybe from Abdul and Mitchell more directly about your thoughts with respect to, if not a party, then what kind of political opportunity did the 60s represent? And since you two were also the ones to say that the 60s did not fail, were not defeated, how does that political opportunity of the 60s persist today?
Okay. Well, to answer, I'm going to answer both questions a little bit. In terms of parties, choosing between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in the United States is like choosing between syphilis and gonorrhea. It's a false choice, and it's a bogus choice. It doesn't represent any alternative. And so I fully agree with those who want to form a different way of doing things. I myself am a part, I was one of the founders in Brooklyn of the New York Green Party, and now I'm very critical of the Greens too for falling into sort of the same way of doing things. That part of the Green Party that supports electoral politics at all is, in my view, messed up. They gave up getting involved in elections in the United States, which is different than in other countries where you could actually make some impact, you know, absorbed all the energy of all these younger Greens and who were doing all sorts of different projects and pushed it all into the electoral arena, in which you waste all your time and money, you know, supporting a candidate here and there. And even if the candidate says good things, it really, I think it pulls apart the movement. Well, it doesn't have to, but there are ways, but the Green Party people have not, the rank and file have not effectively talked with each other and talked about all of this outside of electoral politics in recent years. So I don't know that that represents any alternative either, right? I don't think it does in the electoral arena, for sure it doesn't. So there's one anecdote. The translation of Marx's Capital, the Moore translation from 1909, I think it was. Do you remember in Chicago there was the publisher was based there. It was Franklin Rosamond and Penelope Rosamond became in charge of this publishing house. It was the main publishing house, but I don't remember
the
name.
Charles Kerr.
Right, thanks. Well, when I was friends with Franklin and before he died and Penelope, they were so proud of the fact that they were using the proceeds that they would get ongoing from the translations of Marx's Capital going all the way back to the early, very early 1900s, or even late 1800s, I think, to fund movements today. So in a surreal way, and since they were surrealists, it made a lot of sense, they felt that Marx and Marx's Capital was funding the movements today, and that way bringing Marx into the, at least in terms of the translations of Capital, into funding all sorts of movements and allowing them to flourish. And that was a nice, just a story, but it was a nice way of continuity from the past to the present. So in terms of, one more point, the fight for reproductive rights in this country and everywhere is a class issue. The fight for almost anything we can imagine that we fight for is a class issue. When we allow people to separate and say, oh, that's just identity politics, as if that's a negative, or as if that's missing. I mean, it's our responsibility to bring out the class dimension. But all these issues have a class dimension to it. And it's our job to bring them out and to mobilize our class around it in support of it. So, finally, just 8 years ago, I'll end on this one. 8 years ago, I interviewed for my radio show. I had a radio show at the time called Steal This Radio. And I interviewed two people from Platypus when it was first starting out, right? And we had some debates among each other, and it's online, and maybe even Platypus will put it on the website, I don't know. And you can listen to it, and we had some discussion, light, friendly argument, and I'm really so glad to see that Platypus has actually taken off, and it's becoming a phenomenon that's really important. And this, people should really be proud of yourselves of upholding the idea that people can become conscious of Marxism and a class of, well, what I mean by Marxism is a radical class analysis of society, in addition to the outrage that we feel around different events that happen in the world, there's also the way of analyzing those events. And I think that's really to be proud. The thing that we need to think about, I think, is that where do we take that? How do we make that wider? How do people learn? It's what I started off with saying. How do people learn about socialism? How do people, does it happen by hammering people with, or anything, with an idea? Or do people go through a process by which they become open to different ideas, including the idea of socialism? And then how do we do that so that we begin meeting together each other's needs and desires and in a revolutionary way? So I leave that up there.
Yeah, I think that one of the really powerful lessons of SDS is that it spread. SDS was everywhere, and including the high schools. So, and I want to second what you just said about Platypus and other such organizations. The idea of getting people to study revolutionary ideas in the context of the struggles they're engaged in is a fundamental aspect of what we should all be doing. And it seems to me that one of the great mistakes that can be made is to ignore the ideas that the working class and poor people generally engage with, like the soaps, like television, like the great discussion about Roseanne, like the comic books. And the left has not really paid a lot of attention consistently to this. There's been more interest in sports, and that's a good thing, in terms of class analysis of sports. But that's one aspect of educating the masses of people, intervening in popular culture. The other is the discussion around the new development, the current motion of capital toward this diminishing the demand for labor. Historically, we know when we talk about the working class, the workplace created a discipline that was the basis on which you could then have political organizations expressing that discipline. If we increasingly have the delinking of large sections of the working class, not only in the United States, in the world, that then lead to massive waves of migration that results in fascist developments of reaction to this, including the confusion of progressive parties with regard to these policies. So we have to have an analysis of the new conditions. Like in this country, the role of the social media giants, this whole question of privacy, this whole question of control, what is the relationship between the state and Google / YouTube / Amazon, you know, what's going on? What is the nature of capital in the world today? Who are the grave diggers of capital today? These are fundamentally new questions for us. Now, we can quote the past, but we have to anchor that analysis in, and this is the whole point about, is capitalism viable in the future? What is the nature of capitalism? If the capitalists are not exploiting labor, then how do they reproduce themselves? And if we have a society that produces enough Where's the distribution? That's the fundamental question. How do we distribute all of this stuff so people can eat? And increasingly, with the environmental question, this migration problem is going to be fundamental. So now what I'm talking about is 10, 20, 30 years. So if, in fact, we're embracing the Marxist tradition, it seems to me we have to embrace what's rising. In other words, what Marx was writing about wasn't the full-blown factory system that ultimately developed, but he was able to capture the dynamic there that helped us understand. What is the dynamic today? That's a new question for us. And the brain power in this room can make a great contribution to that. So it's the working class as it existed impacting their consciousness, at the same time trying to understand the motion of capital, but doing that connected to the social motion. So right now, who is bringing revolutionary politics to the high school students that are engaged in this March 24th action? These are real questions. Their minds are now open for us. Black Lives Matter. The NGOs have put millions of dollars into the Black Lives Matter. And if you've noticed, one of them showed up at the Oscars, you know, laid to the nines. You know, what's going on here? You know, young people making $60,000 and $80,000 as movement activists. But the masses of people are ready for revolutionary ideas. But we're not fanning out. And it seems to me that this is the time. And when I said the Pew survey said that they had analyzed who is it that believes in socialism, that's our market share. It's comparable to the Tea Party. The Tea Party are fascist in Congress. But we're not in Congress. I'm not talking about being Democrats. I'm not talking about being servile. I'm talking about being there representing our ideas and forcing them to put the police on us and put us out, polarize it on the basis of something real, but you have to be there. That's the whole point. Engage in the politics of the society in which we live.
The opportunity of the 60s is a huge block of time. I think there's an opportunity sometime in the early 60s that, unfortunately, from the perspective of history, almost seems to have been doomed the more I look into it. In other words, 64, 62, there's the development of there's an opening at the beginnings of the student movement in the 50s, in the late 50s, when there is an opportunity for the recruitment of those people through both like the student movement and the civil rights movement into a massive force that could potentially address the problem of capitalism, could bring about a crisis as Fordism comes into crisis in the 60s, as it eventually does. There's an opportunity in the 70s on the basis of the new leftists of 68, who went back to Marx. And that has more to do with the sort of the development of neoliberalism, right? And there are various ways in which that plays out. I'm sorry if I'm not being specific enough as to what I thought of the various attempts. I do recognize, I'm reminded by the question as well as by the earlier question of from Richard about my pessimism and my skepticism about the history of Marxism. I'm reminded of this little piece here from Trotsky's Stalinism and Bolshevism. There are others less consistent but more numerous who say, on the contrary, we must return Bolshevism to Marxism. How? To what Marxism? Before Marxism became bankrupt in the form of Bolshevism, it had already broken down in the form of social democracy. Does the slogan back to Marxism then mean a leap over the periods of the Second and Third Internationals? To the First International? But it too broke in its time. Thus, in the last analysis, it is a question of returning to the collected works of Marx and Engels. One can accomplish this historic leap without leaving one's study, and even without taking off one's slippers. But how are we going to go from our classics, Marx died in 83, Engels in 95, to the tasks of a new epoch, omitting several decades of theoretical and political struggles, among them Bolsheviks and the October Revolution? None of those who propose to renounce Bolshevism as a historically bankrupt tendency has indicated any other course. So the question is reduced to the simple advice to study Capital. We can hardly object, but the Bolsheviks too studied Capital, and not badly either. This did not, however, prevent the degeneration of the Soviet state and the staging of the Moscow trials. So what is to be done? When I read about the 60s, I sort of put myself in that place, and I don't have an answer. When I think about the present, I feel like I'm in an even darker place, because at least Trotsky had a mass working class movement to try to move towards something, to try to actually transform. There was potentially a revolution to be made in Russia as well as the United States. In the United States in the 60s, I think that I'm not sure what a Marxist revolution would have looked like. I certainly don't. I don't think that Harrington or Rustin or any of the young members of the New Left, certainly a lot of people who were running around saying don't trust anybody over 30, and if you want to make a revolution, you're going to have to kill your parents or think about it at least as a possibility. I don't think those people were about to lead any sort of revolution. And I think by 68, the right has the upper hand and is actually leading the transformation of capitalism. And it's been like that ever since, if not before.
Yes, I'd like to just sort of conclude by thanking Platypus. I didn't know who Platypus were really at all. I sort of vaguely heard of them until about a week ago, when they contacted me. And I didn't. It's really weird how it's a kind of weird loop that I didn't know they knew of me. I didn't know of them. I'm a nobody. So thanks to Platypus for bringing me here. This is great. The Platypus is a really cool organization. It's great to have this kind of discourse going on. So much of the left these days is about kind of like shutting everyone down and everyone kind of retreating off into their little comfort zones. It's great just to have us all together thrashing out like this. Fucking good work, nice one. When I inquired about Platypus, I asked my lefty friends about Platypus. And this is what they had to say about Platypus. This is great. This is brilliant. So I asked my lefty friends, like, oh, yeah, Platypus. Yeah, I've heard about this organization. They reminded me to speak. Like, who are they? And went, Platypus, not a good organization. They want to destroy the left. And I thought, and then I thought to myself, you know what? I'm a member of an organization that's wanted to destroy the left since 1904. I'm among my people here. This is good. So there's this weird thing. I really like animals, and a lot of my work deals with animals. And there's this great bit in Marx, Marx's Capital, where he talks about the worst of architects and the best of bees. And he says that one thing that distinguishes, this could be unfair to bees, I don't know enough about the psyche of bees to say this, but he says that one thing that distinguishes the worst of architects from the best of bees is that, unlike the best of bees, the worst of architects conceive of something before they produce it. And this, to Marx, is a fundamentally human condition, right? And the laborer does this. The laborer looks at this stuff in front of them and they say, okay, let's fold it up and make it into a car or whatever, you know. These are the worker conceptualizes, right? And this, I think, is also what revolutionary consciousness is about. It's about imagining something in the future. So in other words, when I hear people today that are saying, like, oh, don't think of the future, this is idealism, blah, 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 it's not fucking idealism. This is us as working class people reflecting on our material conditions and thinking beyond it, having the imagination to think beyond the material conditions of capitalism. And this ability to think beyond it, I think, comes fundamentally from an understanding of a recognition of the fact that this society is reproduced by our own labor power, okay? This is one of the good things about Sartre, okay? Sartre kind of puts this back into Marx, this idea that capitalism doesn't just happen to us, right? Okay, you know, this is like kind of tied up with Marx's idea of both alienation and ideology. Is that this kind of, there's this thing that happens to us, kind of bows down to all this monster capitalism. No, this monster, we're the ones pulling the puppet strings here. Okay, this is really fundamentally important. Once we understand this, once we understand that this entire thing, everything that we look at around us, everything that fucks us over, everything that makes us want to kill ourselves, everything that makes me carry a hip flask in my pocket, okay, everything that really makes us fucked, right? It's reproduced by us. It's reproduced by our own labour power. This is like, we realise and we think, oh, fuck, that's, you know, no one to blame, first and foremost, okay? You can't blame the capitalist class, so that's a good way to start, okay? Also means that, like, you can't drift off into all the kind of, there's this big thing going on with the anti-Semitism. You can't blame the Jews, okay? You can't blame the Jews. You've got to blame your fucking self as a worker, okay? We're the ones that reproduce this social system. That's fundamentally important to understand. And when we talk about kind of like socialism, we talk about the working class, like, will the working class grasp socialism? I'm a member of the working class. I grasp socialism. Who here, if you're a member of the working class and if you're a socialist, okay, in order to think that the working class can't grasp socialism, you have to think one of two things. You have to think that you're morally superior to the working class or you're intellectually superior to the working class. I don't think I'm intellectually or morally superior to my fellow workers. In fact, I'm probably a lot stupider and fucking more corrupt morally than most, the average worker, okay? Like, the working class can think of this stuff, and they can because we do, okay? We're not detached from the rest of the class, okay? That's one point, okay? Now, finally, you mentioned this incident about the... And this is like a good, really good kind of alternative to striking. This is a good thing about the IWW. It's not all about, like, workplace struggles aren't all about strikes, okay? There's other things you can do. And you mentioned, like, opening up the gates, for example, you know, of the ticket station. It reminded me of this post-situationist film that I watched in art college quite a few years ago. I can't remember anything about it. I'll try and dig it out to anyone who's interested. And it's made in about the 80s. And you've got this punk on one hand and you've got this granny, okay? This is fucking great, right? You've got this punk and you've got this granny, okay? And the granny jumps over the ticket barriers, okay? And the punk takes his chain out, okay? And he whips the ticket barrier, okay? And then he gets his ticket out of his chain, of his wallet, and he uses the ticket and he walks through the ticket barrier. And it's a very short film. This is pretty much all that happens, right? Okay. Well, it might be an excerpt from a film, but anyway, that's the bit that I remember. This was great. I saw this. And I think that's like a really important distinction as well, you know, between the rebel on one hand and the revolutionary. What's wrong about the 60s for me, or what's wrong about aspects of the 60s, is there's a lot of rebels, there's not enough revolutionaries, okay? Now, do me. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you to everybody who came out. So we are actually going to be heading downtown to Exchequer, which is, does anybody know the address? What's the address of Exchequer? Okay.
Yeah, right, man.
Yeah.
You coming through?
Yeah, I'm kind of like...
When you put it like that, you know, how often do you get that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.